Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Szczepańczyk. This is an atypical episode of the Ministry of Truth, mainly given the scope and gravity of the topic we're about to discuss. We will devote nearly the entire show to a radio adaptation of an essay by James Howard Kunstler, published on April 13, 2005 in Rolling Stone magazine. The essay is entitled, "The Long Emergency: What's Going to Happen as We Start Running Out of Cheap Gas to Guzzle?" The essay speaks to the impending and likely unavoidable collapse of the United States economy and perhaps the world economy as a result of diminishing oil supplies. And given the length of the adaptation, this episode will forego our usual public service announcement and headlines from the New Standard. We will include a summary of news about media and democracy entitled Media Minutes, which will begin in a moment. You're listening to the Ministry of Truth.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Advocates for the development of community internet go on the offensive in the fight to stop telecom companies from convincing lawmakers to ban such projects on a state-by-state basis. Big Telecom's been spreading much disinformation about the viability of community broadband, whether it be about the financial health of such projects or their actual economic impact on cities and towns that have tried them. Specifically, Verizon's been circulating an unsigned pseudo-fact sheet touting several examples of supposedly failed community internet projects around the country. That document's now been deconstructed point by point, and it turns out that Verizon used obsolete data and twisted the stories of actual successful projects to paint them as failures. Free Press project manager Franny Wellings wrote the report, setting the record straight about Verizon's misinformation. She says the company's research began to unravel as soon as she started digging into it.
I called up everybody, including projects that Verizon had said didn't exist anymore. Then you look online and see they've got a website and they're fully functioning.
A couple of examples demonstrate the misinformation at work. Verizon claims Dickinson County, Virginia sold off its wireless network to a contractor who then lowered the monthly access fee while maintaining the same level of service. The truth is, the network is fully functional today, still in county hands, and the county was the one who reduced fees by $5 a month because the network runs so smoothly. In fact, Verizon itself once made an unsolicited offer to buy the network, only to be rebuffed by Dickinson County. Then there is the fiber optic network financed by the city of Cedar Falls, Iowa. Verizon says it's lost money in every year of operation. The real story is the network went cash flow positive in 1997, broke even in 1998, turned a net profit in 2003, and is given partial credit for tripling the amount of new development in the city. Wellings says breaking the news about Verizon's claims to those the company cited as failures was an interesting experience, to say the least.
Most of these people did not know. Most of them were obviously upset that they were, number one, being used for this campaign, and number two, being lied about.
Part of the disconnect between Verizon and the truth was due to the company's use of the maximization of profit as the barometer of success for community internet projects, when none of them were really set up with that as a primary goal.
Private companies and municipalities would judge the success of a project very differently. So in cities where residents were never able to get access to broadband because private companies did not see it as profitable for them, municipalities have gone into business. Municipalities see that as being successful because they're actually serving their community.
Verizon has since admitted to authoring and circulating the false fact sheet, but has made no other comment about being debunked so thoroughly.
Cable companies doing business in Arizona lose a campaign to pad their pockets with extra profit at the expense of public service. A bill that would have forced cities and towns to cut cable company franchise fees by 20% while closing public access channels just got voted down in the Arizona legislature. The bill was backed by cable companies including Adelphia, Comcast, Cox, and Mediacom. They tried to sell it as some kind of tax relief that would have lowered monthly bills. But City of Phoenix Mayor Phil Gordon says the truth of the matter was that it would have sucked money right out of local coffers to the tune of $8 million a year in his community alone.
$8 million a year is the same as the salaries for 150 new Phoenix police officers or firefighters. It's the same as closing down the main City of Phoenix library forever. That's what $8 million a year does for us.
Lobbyists for the cable companies tried some last-minute parliamentary moves to keep the legislation alive, but strong opposition from the grassroots convinced lawmakers to vote it down. Larry Nelson, mayor of Yuma, Arizona, says the entire proceeding reeked of hypocrisy.
States' rights is a major issue with our legislature. And the very party that wants that, I'm affiliated with it, but yet they don't want to recognize the local rights.
Had the Arizona bill passed, it would have set a dangerous precedent, as similar efforts to cut franchise fees and cripple public access to cable systems are pending in another half dozen states.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
This is the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchik. We now present a radio adaptation of an essay by James Howard Kunstler, published on April 13, 2005 in Rolling Stone magazine. The essay is entitled, The Long Emergency, What's Going to Happen as We Start Running Out of Cheap Gas to Guzzle? In February 2005, the price of oil ratcheted above $55 a barrel, which is about $20 a barrel more than a year previously. The next day, the oil story was buried on page 6 of the New York Times business section. Apparently, the price of oil is not considered significant news, even when it goes up $5 a barrel in the span of 10 days. That same day, the stock market shot up more than 100 points because, according to CNN, government data showed no signs of inflation. Note to clueless nation, call planet Earth. Carl Jung, one of the fathers of psychology, famously remarked that people cannot stand too much reality. What you're about to hear may challenge your assumptions about the kind of world we live in, and especially the kind of world into events are propelling us. We are in for a rough ride through uncharted territory. It has been very hard for Americans, lost in dark raptures of nonstop infotainment, recreational shopping, and compulsive motoring, to make sense of the gathering forces that will fundamentally alter the terms of everyday life in our technological society. Even after the terrorist attacks of 9/11, America is still sleepwalking into the future. I call this coming time the long emergency. Most immediately, we face the end of the cheap fossil fuel era. It is no exaggeration to state that reliable supplies of cheap oil and natural gas underlie everything we identify as the necessities of modern life, not to mention all of its comforts and luxuries. Central heating, air conditioning, cars, airplanes, electric lights, inexpensive clothing, recorded music, movies, hip replacement surgery, national defense, you name it. The few Americans who are even aware that there is a gathering global energy predicament usually misunderstand the core of the argument. That argument states that we don't have to run out of oil to start having severe problems with industrial civilization and its dependent systems. We have only to slip over the all-time production peak and begin a slide down the arc of steady depletion. The term global oil production peak means that a turning point will come when the world produces the most oil it will ever produce in a given year, and after that, yearly production will inexorably decline. It is usually represented graphically in a bell curve. The peak is the top of the curve, the halfway point of the world's all-time total endowment, meaning half the world's oil will be left. That seems like a lot of oil, and it is, but there is a big catch. It's the half that is much more difficult to extract, far more costly to get, of much poorer quality, and located mostly in places where the people hate us. A substantial amount of it will never be extracted. The United States passed its own oil peak, about 11 million barrels a day, in 1970, and since then production has dropped steadily. In 2004, it ran just above 5 million barrels a day. We get a tad more from natural gas condensates. Yet we consume roughly 20 million barrels a day now. That means we have to import about two-thirds of our oil, and the ratio will continue to worsen. The U.S. peak in 1970 brought on a portentous change in geoeconomic power. Within a few years, foreign producers, chiefly OPEC, were setting the price of oil, and this in turn led to the oil crises of the 1970s. In response, frantic development of non-OPEC oil, especially the North Sea fields of England and Norway, essentially saved the West's ass for about two decades. Since 1999, these fields have entered depletion. Meanwhile, worldwide discovery of new oil has steadily declined to insignificant levels in 2003 and 2004. Some cornucopians claim that the Earth has something like a creamy nougat center of abiotic oil that will naturally replenish the great oil fields of the world. The facts speak differently. There has been no replacement whatsoever of oil already extracted from the fields of America or any other place. Now we are faced with the global oil production peak. The best estimates of when this will actually happen have been somewhere between now and 2010. In 2004, however, after demand from burgeoning China and India shot up, and revelations that Shell Oil wildly misstated its reserves, and Saudi Arabia proved incapable of goosing up its production despite promises to do so, the most knowledgeable experts revised their predictions and now concur that 2005 is apt to be the year of all-time global peak production. It will change everything about how we live. To aggravate matters, American natural gas production is also declining, at 5% a year, despite frenetic new drilling and with the potential of much steeper declines ahead. Because of the oil crises of the 1970s, the nuclear plant disasters at Three Mile Island in Chernobyl, and the acid rain problem, the U.S. chose to make gas its first choice for electric power generation. The result was that just about every power plant built after 1980 has to run on gas. Half the homes in America are heated with gas. To further complicate matters, gas isn't easy to import. Here in North America, it is distributed through a vast pipeline network. Gas imported from overseas would have to be compressed at minus 260 degrees Fahrenheit in pressurized tanker ships and unloaded, regasified, at special terminals, of which few exist in America. Moreover, the first attempts to site new terminals have met furious opposition because they are such ripe targets for terrorism. Some other things about the global energy predicament are poorly understood by the public and even our leaders. This is going to be a permanent energy crisis, and these energy problems will synergize with the disruptions of climate change, epidemic disease, and population overshoot to produce higher orders of trouble. We will have to accommodate ourselves to fundamentally changed conditions. No combination of alternative fuels will allow us to run American life the way we have been used to running it, or even a substantial fraction of it. The wonders of steady technological progress achieved through the reign of cheap oil have lulled us into a kind of Jiminy Cricket syndrome, leading many Americans to believe that anything we wish for hard enough will come true. These days, even people who ought to know better are wishing ardently for a seamless transition from fossil fuels to their putative replacements. The widely touted hydrogen economy is a particularly cruel hoax. We are not going to replace the U.S. automobile and truck fleet with vehicles run on fuel cells. For one thing, the current generation of fuel cells is largely designed to run on hydrogen obtained from natural gas. The other way to get hydrogen in the quantities wished for would be electrolysis of water using power from hundreds of nuclear power plants. Apart from the dim prospect of our building that many nuclear plants soon enough, there are also numerous severe problems with hydrogen's nature as an element that prevents forbidding obstacles to its use as a replacement for oil and gas, especially in storage and transport. Wishful notions about rescuing our way of life with renewables are also, unfortunately, unrealistic. Solar electric systems and wind turbines face not only the enormous problem of scale, but the fact that the components require substantial amounts of energy to manufacture, and the probability that they can't be manufactured at all without the underlying support platform of a fossil fuel economy. We will surely use solar and wind technology to generate some electricity for a period ahead, but probably at a very local and small scale. Virtually all biomass schemes for using plants to create liquid fuels cannot be scaled up to even a fraction of the level at which they are currently run. What's more, these schemes are predicated on using oil and gas inputs, fertilizers and weed killers, for example, to grow the biomass crops that would be converted into ethanol or biodiesel fuels. This is a net energy loser. You might as well burn the inputs and not bother with the biomass products. Proposals to distill trash and waste into oil by means of thermal depolymerization depend on the huge waste stream produced by a cheap oil and gas economy in the first place. Coal is far less versatile than oil and gas, extant in less abundant supplies than many people assume and fraught with huge ecological drawbacks, as it contributed to greenhouse global warming gases and many health and toxicity issues ranging from widespread mercury poisoning to acid rain. You can make synthetic oil from coal, but the only time this was tried on a large scale was by the Nazis under wartime conditions, using impressive amounts of slave labor. If we wish to keep the lights on in America after 2020, one option may indeed be nuclear power, with all its practical problems and eco-conundrums. Under optimal conditions, it could take 10 years to get a new generation of nuclear power plants into operation, and the price, including ecological price, may be well beyond our means. Uranium is also a resource in finite supply. We are no closer to the more difficult projection of atomic fusion, by the way, than we were in the 1970s. The upshot of all this is that we are entering a historical period of potentially great instability, turbulence, and hardship. Obviously, geopolitical maneuvering around the world's richest energy regions has already led to war and promises more international military conflict. Since the Middle East contains two-thirds of the world's remaining oil supplies, the U.S. has attempted desperately to stabilize the region by, in effect, opening a big police station in Iraq. The intent was not just to secure Iraq's oil, but to modify and influence the behavior of neighboring states around the Persian Gulf, especially Iran and Saudi Arabia. The results have been far from entirely positive, and our future prospects in that part of the world are not something we can feel altogether confident about. And then there is the issue of China, which in 2004 became the world's second greatest consumer of oil, surpassing Japan. China's surging industrial growth has made it increasingly dependent on the exports we are counting on. If China wanted to, it could easily walk into some of these places, the Middle East, former Soviet republics in Central Asia, and extend its hegemony by force. Is America prepared to contest for this oil in an Asian land war with the Chinese army? I doubt it. Nor can the U.S. military occupy regions of the Eastern Hemisphere indefinitely, or hope to secure either the terrain or the oil infrastructure of one distant, unfriendly country after another. A likely scenario is that the U.S. could exhaust and bankrupt itself trying to do so, and be forced to withdraw back into our own hemisphere, having lost access to most of the world's remaining oil in the process. We know that our national leaders are hardly uninformed about this predicament. George W. Bush has been briefed on the dangers of the oil peak situation as long ago as before the 2000 election, and repeatedly since then. In March 2005, the Department of Energy released a report that officially acknowledges for the first time that peak oil is for real, and states plainly that, quote, "the world has never faced a problem like this. Without massive mitigation more than a decade before the fact, the problem will be pervasive and will not be temporary," unquote. Most of all, the long emergency will require us to make other arrangements for the way we live in the United States. America is in a special predicament due to a set of unfortunate choices we made as a society in the 20th century. Perhaps the worst was to let our towns and cities rot away and to replace them with suburbia, which had the additional side effect of trashing a lot of the best farmland in America. Suburbia will come to be regarded as the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world. It has a tragic destiny. The psychology of previous investment suggests that we will defend our drive-in utopia long after it has become a terrible liability. Before long, the suburbs will fail us in practical terms. We made the ongoing development of housing subdivisions, highway strips, fried food shacks, and shopping malls the basis of our economy. And when we will have to stop making more of those things, the bottom will fall out. The circumstances of the long emergency will require us to downscale and rescale virtually everything we do and how we do it, from the kind of communities we physically inhabit to the way we grow our food to the way we work and the trade of the products of our work. Our lives will become profoundly and intensely local. Daily life will be far less about mobility and much more about staying where you are. Anything organized on the large scale, whether it is government or a corporate business enterprise such as Walmart, will wither as the cheap energy props that support bigness fall away. The turbulence of the long emergency will produce a lot of economic losers, and many of these will be members of an angry and aggrieved former middle class. Food production is going to be an enormous problem in the long emergency. As industrial agriculture fails due to a scarcity of oil and gas-based inputs, we will certainly have to grow more of our food closer to where we live and do it on a smaller scale. The American economy of the mid-21st century may actually center on agriculture, not information, not high tech, not services like real estate sales or hawking cheeseburgers to tourists. Farming. This is no doubt a startling, radical idea, and it raises extremely difficult questions about the reallocation of land and the nature of work. The relentless subdividing of land in the late 20th century has destroyed the contiguity and integrity of the rural landscape in most places. The process of readjustment is apt to be disorderly and improvisational. Food production will necessarily be more labor-intensive than it has been for decades. we can anticipate the reformation of a native-born American farm laboring class. It will be composed largely of the aforementioned economic losers who had to relinquish their grip on the American dream. These masses of disentitled people may enter into quasi-feudal social relations with those who own land in exchange for food and physical security. But their sense of grievance will remain fresh, and if mistreated, they may simply seize that land. The way that commerce is currently organized in America will not survive far into the long emergency. Walmart's warehouse on wheels won't be such a bargain in a non-cheap oil economy. The national chain store's 12,000-mile manufacturing supply lines could easily be interrupted by military contests over oil and by internal conflict in the nations that have been supplying us with ultra-cheap manufactured goods, because they, too, will be struggling with similar issues of energy famine and all the disorders that go with it. As these things occur, America will have to make other arrangements for the manufacture, distribution, and sale of ordinary goods. They will probably be made on a cottage industry basis rather than the factory system we once had, since the scale of available energy will be much lower, and we are not going to replay the 20th century. Tens of thousands of the common products we enjoy today, from paints to pharmaceuticals, are made out of oil. They will become increasingly scarce or unavailable. The selling of things will have to be reorganized at the local scale. It will have to be based on moving merchandise shorter distances. It is almost certain to result in higher costs for the things we buy and far fewer choices. The automobile will be a diminished presence in our lives, to say the least. With gasoline in short supply, not to mention tax revenue, our roads will surely suffer. The interstate highway system is more delicate than the public realizes. If the level of service, as traffic engineers call it, is not maintained to the highest degree, problems multiply and escalate quickly. The system does not tolerate partial failure. The interstates are either in excellent condition or they quickly fall apart. America today has a railroad system that the Bulgarians would be ashamed of. Neither of the two major presidential candidates in 2004 mentioned railroads. But if we don't refurbish our rail system, then there may be no long-range travel or transport of goods at all a few decades from now. The commercial aviation industry, already on its knees financially, is likely to vanish entirely. The sheer cost of maintaining gigantic airports may not justify the operation of a much-reduced air travel fleet. Railroads are far more energy efficient than cars, trucks, or airplanes, and they can be run on anything from wood to electricity. The railbed infrastructure is also far more economical to maintain than our highway network. The successful regions in the 21st century will be the ones surrounded by viable farming hinterlands that can reconstitute locally sustainable economies on an armature of civic cohesion. Small towns and smaller cities have better prospects than the big cities, which will probably have to contract substantially. The process will be painful and tumultuous. In many American cities, such as Cleveland, Detroit, and St. Louis, that process is already well advanced. Others have further to fall. New York and Chicago face extraordinary difficulties, being oversupplied with gigantic buildings out of scale with the reality of declining energy supplies. Their former agricultural hinterlands have long been paved over. They will be encysted in a surrounding fabric of necrotic suburbia that will only amplify and reinforce the city's problems. Still, our cities occupy important sites. Some kind of urban entities will exist where they are in the future, but probably not the colossi of 20th century industrialism. Some regions of the country will do better than others in the long emergency. The Southwest will suffer in proportion to the degree that it prospered during the cheap oil blowout of the late 20th century. I predict that Sunbelt states like Arizona and Nevada will become significantly depopulated, since the region will be short of water as well as gasoline and natural gas. Imagine Phoenix without cheap air conditioning. I'm not optimistic about the Southeast either, for different reasons. I think it will be subject to substantial levels of violence as the grievances of the formerly middle class boil over and collide with delusions of Pentecostal Christian extremism. The latent, encoded behavior of Southern culture includes an outsized notion of individualism and the belief that firearms ought to be used in the defense of it. This is a poor recipe, to say the least, for civic cohesion. The mountain states and Great Plains will face an array of problems, from poor farming potential to water shortages to population loss. The Pacific Northwest, New England, and Upper Midwest have somewhat better prospects. I regard them as less likely to fall into lawlessness, chaos, or despotism, and more likely to salvage the bits and pieces of our best social traditions and keep them in operation at some level. These are daunting and even dreadful prospects. The long emergency is going to be a tremendous trauma for the human race. We will not believe that this is happening to us, that 200 years of modernity can be brought to its knees by a worldwide power shortage. The survivors will have to cultivate a religion of hope. That is, a deep and comprehensive belief that humanity is worth carrying on. If there is any positive side to stark changes coming our way, it may be in the benefits of our close communal relations, of having to really work intimately and physically with our neighbors, to be part of an enterprise that really matters, and to be fully engaged in meaningful social enactments instead of being merely entertained to avoid boredom. Years from now, when we hear singing at all, we will hear ourselves, and we will sing with our whole hearts. Adapted from The Long Emergency, 2005, by James Howard Kunstler and reprinted with permission of the publisher, Grove Atlantic Incorporated. Copyright 2005, Rolling Stone. You're listening to The Ministry of Truth.